This is Breaking Ground, the voice of Geotechnics, produced in the UK, enjoyed around the world. I'm Steve Hadley, and on this episode, I'll be learning more about joint ventures and getting an industry news update. That's coming up after this.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board, and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical, and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant, and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
So today we're going to be talking about collaboration and a business model that has become more popular in the geo sector in recent years. You've probably heard the term joint ventures before. Now, to help me do that, I'm joined by two of its proponents, Jane Towse-Lavelle, who's a director of Balfour Beatty Ground Engineering, and Phil Hines, UK Group Managing Director at Bashi Solitonch. And Phil's actually the immediate past chair of the Federation of Piling Specialists, the previous incumbent of my position. We'll also be meeting later in the show Nia Kajesti from Ground Engineering Magazine, to get some news updates from what's happening in the industry and within that publication and all things EMAP. Welcome, Phil and Jane, first of all. Thank you for joining me. So let's start, I think, with maybe a few definitions and explore what a joint venture is. We see a few different terms knocked around. For instance, special purpose vehicle seems to be a popular one, but how would you, Phil, define a joint venture?
Well, for me, I suppose a joint venture is a collaboration between a number of parties. It can be two, it could be more than two. And so it's people getting together to either do something on a particular project or to do things as a particular series of projects. But it's basically getting together with someone else to do a job together.
I don't know that they're new, if you like, because I first worked in joint venture with Solitonch, actually, for the Jubilee line when that was constructed. It was a number of years ago, 1994, something like that. And there was a lot of collaboration then between different piling communities because it was a large scheme. And then obviously, even since then, there's been a number of joint venture collaborations going on the sort of the Tideway and the Crossrail, those sorts of ventures. So they're not necessarily that new.
Not new, but how would you define it? It doesn't have to be a contractual entity in itself, does it? We could be talking just about partnerships. Do you actually have to set up a company for it to be a joint venture, or is this really a catch-all term?
Yeah, for me, that there are two distinct ways of doing it. Either you set up a legal entity, a joint venture of two companies that's forming one company, or you do it as a contract arrangement where you basically have a joint venture agreement, but that it's not a corporate structure in its own right. So, for instance, Jane and I, we've got a contract arrangement. It's a joint venture for a particular project, and that it's not a legal entity in itself.
Okay, so you're just deciding what resources would go into it, and we'll talk a little bit more later on about what sort of things might be applied and the types of agreement that might be in place. But why would you form a joint venture? What are you looking for? Why is the sum bigger than the parts in this sense?
Well, I think on you can see from where Phil and I are, obviously on whether it be the M4 or on HS2, obviously we are working for our parent companies who have decided to form a joint venture. So you can see there's a kind of an automatic good reason for us you know, they wouldn't choose between us as to who is their, you know, preferred piling contractor. They would want us to work together to work for them, who are working collaboratively together. So that's one reason. But obviously there's many others. But, you know, where you're wanting to share risk, or there is a huge demand for resource, and you can complement each other's resource or complement each other's operating procedures. There's all sorts of things that you can do to complement each other and work together to give a better benefit for your client and for your businesses.
I can certainly see why, if the two big companies, so we're talking about Balfour Beatty and Vinci, want to work together. Yeah, they wouldn't want to just decide, oh, let's pick BBGE for this scheme. It would feel rather unfair. But in terms of the skill sets, I guess from an outsider, I would say that actually probably your offerings in terms of geotechnical services are fairly similar. Is that a fair point, or is there complementary services that you provide, Phil?
Well, there's one schemes? Obvious huge advantage in partnering with Bashi Soltanth for GE, in that Bashi Soltanth have got the hydrophase capability, and they bring that in. So on other areas of the joint venture, you know, other parties in the UK have had to perhaps look at foreign partners, where, you know, Bashi Soltanth already bring to the table that whole expertise from France and Europe.
Yeah, that's interesting, because Phil and I have been having a conversation recently, Jane, about resourcing. I'm sure you're having similar concerns and conversations because of this very specialist skill set needed for diaphragm wall construction. So the hydrophase operator and the bentonite plant operators, and there's not a plethora of those individuals in the country. And with the scale of a joint venture operation and your combined resources, presumably it becomes slightly easier to find those niche roles within the group.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly from our perspective was the intent when we first started looking at HS2. But the unintended consequences of the Brexit and the immigration rules has stymied a lot of that and made it, I think, very difficult to get highly skilled people who haven't got degrees into the country on a skilled workers or an intra-company transfer visa. So it's one of the current challenges that I in my FES role are trying to push forward, is to get people to recognise that for these major infrastructure projects that are ongoing in the UK, HS2 and the others that are being looked at, we really need the government to look at the skilled people who actually do the work. It's not just the people with degree level qualifications that we need. There's some very highly skilled people in these very expensive pieces of equipment that currently are just deemed to be or are viewed as machine operators by the immigration sort of allocations. And so we're trying to build up a bit of head of steam to get people to see that and work out how we can deal with it.
Thanks, Phil. Yeah, I know the audience might think it was slightly off point from JVs, but I think it is really an important message to be getting out there, and certainly through our roles within the FPS, but I know the Ground Forum, obviously a supporter of this podcast, is also going to be looking at petitioning government to try and get these particular roles that we're struggling to fill enable us to get those shortages into the UK.
Coming back to your question, Steve, originally, which is why JV, I suppose there are a couple more examples of why people would joint venture, and it's not just because you've got more resource. It can be that you've got different resources, as you sort of indicated. If you want to team up with someone who does hydrophase work before, because you don't, but you've got other skills, so that's one reason. Another one could be that you're going to work and you want to work in a foreign country and you haven't got a local presence, but you've got a technical skill that a project needs, and therefore you might take a partner to bring that local knowledge.
Yeah, I think that there are countries around the world where it's almost impossible to work without having a local partner. I think the Middle East has been well recognised that you do need a sponsor company to work with in those countries. Of course, they know the culture as well, which is a clear benefit. They know how to operate in those ground conditions as well. So whilst you might have some of the technical skills bringing across from the UK and the plant required, there is clearly a benefit from working with local businesses as well. And when we're talking about such major schemes, there's the financial and risk element as well that's important to consider. So yeah, I can absolutely understand why on such large projects, particularly infrastructure projects, it is beneficial. So
you touched on an interesting point there, Steve, because Jane and I are in joint venture where two geotechnical companies working together for a given reason. But that's not always the case. We're working on Tideway with Costain and Vinci on the east section because the geotechnical content of the project is significant, and we can bring that geotechnical skill into the joint venture to have a competitive team and better manage the risks by being part of the main joint venture. So in that case, we're actually a share. We have a 20% share in the main joint venture rather than being a subcontractor. And that's another example of the geotechnical specialist bringing value into the main contract arena.
It's good to hear. You've recently completed a project. I think it was the M4 or the M40 you worked together on.
So the M4 was recently completed, and then I think the last time before that was the Tottenham Court Road ticket hall, where we'd also worked in joint venture, but that was probably 10 years ago, maybe 9 years ago, Phil.
Yeah, before Jane's time, almost, okay. or previous time. Yeah, that was an interesting job, and you realise how old you're becoming when you have to stretch back to think more than 10 years ago. But yeah,
because I noticed on your CV, Jane, that you were previously were a highways contracts manager. You had the sort of main contractor perspective on it. Is that correct?
No, not really. We have done projects where we've been a principal contractor or main contractor. I did get a time where I spent a period in highways. You're absolutely right with that part of Balfour Beatty. So yeah, I've had a little glimpse of both sides of the fence.
Yeah, what sort of things did you take from that period into going back into the sort of specialist subcontractor role? Was there certain things that you thought, because you'd previously worked as a piling contractor, I can see things differently now. I'm not a subcontractor. And what did you take back?
I think that was the collaboration side. So it was interesting that before, we used to think, something's not ready and we can't move forward. But often getting into the, trying to understand from the point of view of the main contractor, they're dealing with many, many things, aren't they? And we're only one part of what they've got to deal with, and they're not specialists, so they don't know what they don't know. So often try to help them get ahead with them to help them through some of the hurdles that they're going to face, rather than waiting till the hurdle comes up and then being stuck, I think is always a good thing to do. And that's exactly, you don't need to maybe be a main contractor to work that out, but it's the sort of thing that's, Phil and I have worked on, and Phil longer than I have, with HS2, to try and help them along their journey and try and flag up to them the things that are going to give them a problem, because we have a much more detailed view of what's coming.
Yeah, so that thing, early subcontractor involvement is key, and you've lived both sides of it.
That's an interesting point, because it seems new now because everyone's talking about HS2 starting, but in the reality that Balfour Beatty Rail Engineering and Brashey Solitons have been involved for almost 7 years now on HS2 wow. with BBV to get to this point. So for me, it's been a long journey and it's been interesting, but it's been good to have that opportunity to be involved and add the value through that early contractor involvement stage and the pre-qualification stage, so that we can add the value as specialists in the team. And I think that's really important. And has been beneficial to us to understand our client, and also for them to get the benefit of having a specialist on board early.
So when you look at the experience that you had at Tottenham Court Road on the M4, What were the greatest challenges as a JV and making it all click together as sort of two teams becoming one?
The key is people to start with, is getting that is getting the team together and getting the culture of the businesses aligned. Naturally, all businesses are different, so you've got to try and meld that into one team and avoid getting into the situations which can happen where joint ventures are fighting each other and they're therefore not aligned, and then you don't get the right outcomes because you've got twice as much problem to deal with, as well as sort of dealing with internal as well as the challenges of the project itself.
So I suppose what's crucial then is really picking the right partner in the first place. Now, you spoke about the parent companies there were already joined, but there must have been things that they were looking at and you were looking at when you were deciding whether or not to form the JV. And what type of things were they?
Well, it goes back, if you look over history, so the values that we live by in terms of, you know, Bashi and GE, and, you know, where we've partnered with others, our safety standards, we're both striving for exactly, you know, the highest standards. So there's nothing, you know, it would be no good if you were partnering with somebody or joint venturing with somebody and they weren't interested in, you know, meeting all of the FPS criteria and all of the highest standards that we could achieve, as an example. Similar, you know, so it's that kind of culture and values that you're looking for in your partner. So, you know, Bashi's all sorts of venture with others. We've joint ventured very successfully with Cementation, again, because we're on very, you know, we're thinking the same way when it comes to quality, safety, as well as the operational challenges,
yeah,
and the risks.
So you look at the values, you look at how they operate, you look at what's their performance been like as a business, but also on joint ventures in the past, presumably, because you mentioned that there was another project you were involved with there. Sorry, was it Thames Tideway you mentioned, or Lower Thames Crossing, where you'd... you'd had a JV with another business, and I suppose when you're considering whether to JV with somebody, you do your due diligence, you see how those projects perform, you get some references, and really look into it in a lot of detail, because I suppose there is the potential for it going wrong. There's a lot of benefits, but if it goes wrong, yeah, Phil, it could go wrong in a big way.
And unfortunately, we've had our fair share of those, so it's not all rosy. We did a job in Greece, probably now 25 years ago, with a Danish partner, and the Danish partner went bust. And the thing with a joint venture is that if you're joint and severally liable, then your partner disappears, then you end up with 100% of the responsibility under the contract.
Yeah.
So we ended up with many years trying to resolve a project in a foreign country with some of the areas of work not necessarily under our full understanding, and that then drew a lot of attention and took a lot of the company's energy to resolve it.
Yeah, and so you've got all those bills, you've got all these concrete bills that have come in, that the other company no longer exists, you've got to pay for the lot. Seems pretty harsh.
Well, that doesn't... you still get... The contract still pays the money, and obviously they don't take any more money out of the joint venture. So if a job's going okay and you can cover it, then it's not so much of a problem. But normally these problems exist on jobs where you're losing money because of difficult clients or contractual discussions that haven't come to a fruition that affect cash flow. And we ended up in a situation on a project where there were lots of claims and the job wasn't going well. Your partner goes out of business and, well, okay, what do you do? First thing is, well, what happens to all their employees? All their employees on the project, they're not getting paid, so they're going to disappear, or you've got to try and encourage them to stay. You've got to then build another team, so that then has a knock-on effect on the progress of the project. So... Mm-hmm. There are risks with joint ventures as well as, with all these things, that it's not only positives in that respect that you've got to be careful of.
I was reading, I was doing some research, listeners will be pleased to hear before the podcast, and there's a really good section in the IC Manual of Construction Law, just showing it to our guests there, with a lawyer's written a big chapter on joint ventures, and actually in there they were given an example of the Bruntsfield oil explosion, and they were saying how there was a huge claim. It was sort of £750 million, and the companies were, I think, initially expecting it to be the explosion to be the responsibility of the JV, and that wasn't actually the case. So what the court decided in that instance was that it was, and I think the employer was Total. Total employed the individuals that were shown to be responsible for the explosion, and therefore, even though it was a JV and they were working as a joint venture, Total were responsible for the fines and the costs attributed to that accident, which I found really interesting, because I was under the impression that it set up almost as a new business. I don't know the ins and outs of this case, but if it's set up as a new business, that they would be responsible for everything. But that's not necessarily so. And so I think companies do need to be aware when they go into these things that it doesn't absolve the parent company from responsibilities.
There are certain things that, because it's not a legal entity, so... First of all, Steve, I've got to big you up. You're on this. You're on holiday. You're in your camper van, and then you've got this IC book that you're obviously reading. Now, if my wife saw that, she'd be thrown out the window. So,
yeah, well, mine's disappeared somewhere. I'm getting blown around a bit here, so apologies if anybody gets some interference. It is blowing about 40 mile an hour down in Dorset at the moment, so probably not. Not the right sort of weather to be on the beach, anyway.
But coming back to your point, in a joint venture, if there is a legal, if you do something wrong, it might be the environmental agency. You might have a spillage or something, and they might decide to take you to court. They won't take the joint venture to court because it's not a legal entity. They'll go to each of the partners, the partner companies, and they'll go for both of those as their direction of recourse.
Yeah, and that's where, coming back to that joint venture agreement, obviously, I think one of the latest examples of where a joint venture has been left with one partner holding the baby, so to speak, would be, you know, the joint venture Buffer Beatty had with Carillion up in Aberdeen when Carillion went bust. You know, there was a lot of fallout from that. So in our agreement, we've covered off things like, you know, it's very unlikely that either Bashy or Buffer Beatty Ground Engineering are not going to be an entity. But, you know, what would happen? Who would... You know, would the plant, for example, stay on site? You know, as Phil said, all of those things are covered. And it also covers things like what would happen if there was a fine for some sort of health and safety breach or environmental breach. That's what the joint venture agreement has to try and think and cover off, just in the same way any contract, you know, that we enter into when we go on site covers off.
Yeah, that's an interesting term, which I have picked up on joint venture agreement. There's also something called memorandum of understanding that seems to be applied to joint ventures. So are either of you aware of what the difference is between those things? Is it just maybe whether one's actually a formalised company and the other is a more sort of...
Well, if you were setting up a company, then that would be certainly a starting point. And it's sometimes the case, even with a contract JV, that rather than writing a 60-page joint venture agreement, you have a shorter agreement. And the Balfour Beatty Ground Engineering and Solid Thomas Bashy had that for HS2. It was there was so much uncertainty in what the detailed scope of the project was going to be that we just set out some broad brush principles that we were going to adopt for the project, and we agreed those 8 years ago, and therefore they covered the whole of the HS2 project. And what we said is that okay, they will get replaced by a formal joint venture agreement in respect of whichever contracts we were to get awarded.
Let's make it a really simple example for me and to help the listeners understand as well. You've got a 1,000-pile job. Bashy, they put in 200 piles, and BBG put in 800 piles.
You've got it wrong straight away. You've got it wrong straight away.
Well, yeah, so, maybe
because you don't switch, work. That's not how it works.
So, it doesn't matter.
I suppose that is an interesting point of discussion. It's probably one of the principles of the joint venture because there are two. If you have a contract JV, there are two distinct types. There's a fully integrated joint venture, which is what Jane and I have, yeah. Or you can form a consortium. So a fully integrated joint venture is where you basically form one team, and therefore in your piling instance, it is not Balfour Beatty Grand Engineering doing 80 piles, Bashi Solezance doing 20 piles. It is SB3 joint venture doing 100 piles. Now, if it was a consortium, that could be done slightly differently, and you wouldn't tend to do that. I think where we've done consortiums before is where our work scope can be dissociated from the rest of the project. So it might be on a job where you've got 50% of the value of the projects in the foundations and 50% of it is on the follow-on works. So in that stage, you might find a partner who doesn't want to be involved in the risk on the geotechnical works, and we don't want to be involved in the risk on the follow-on works. But together, we've got a winning team because we're both very good at what we do. And in that instance, yes, you are totally responsible for the foundation works and its influence on your partner's work. So if the geotechnical contractor is late on the delivery of the piling works, and the follow-on contractor or your partner doing the follow-on works can't recover it, and the client, for example, charges you LDs for being late, then it wouldn't be shared. It would be the piling company's responsibility in that particular instance.
Okay, but generally what you're doing is you're sharing resources, and there's a commitment to what those resources are, and therefore you're paid according to those commitments. What you're not doing is being paid for the work, the measured works done. That presumably wouldn't be in the spirit or the wording of the
yeah JV. So if you take the M4 at different times along that, you know, the year that we were on the M4, there was different times. At some point in time there would be several crews from, say, BBG, and none at all from Bashi directly. And at other times in the months, there was a lot more crews there from Bashi and none from GE. That doesn't matter. Each partner is paid for any direct resource that it puts in. But overall, the actual accounting as the scheme, you know, is that is done by the actual team, that is a joined up team. And therefore you don't know, you know, it doesn't matter who they work for. And there'll be times when there'll be, you know, a mixture of the crews would be mixed up. It would just be who has got the right supervisor, who has got the right size, you know, or rig or whatever. They're just, you know, we just draw on them as if you were drawing from a pool of resource.
Okay, yeah, and people will put in a timesheet and you've got a list of resources and what they would be charged out at. Is that... Basically,
yeah, you either work on actual cost or you agree in your joint venture agreement rates for people and plant. I mean, and you charge into the joint venture the cost, and the client pays you your value, and the difference is split, which is the profit from the joint venture is split in defined shares in the joint venture agreement.
Actually, seems fairly straightforward.
Yeah, so, and typically over the years, as I say, you know, going through from when back in the day, sort of first worked with Solitonic, or with, you know, we've joint ventured in GE with, whether it be cementation or with Bashi, you know, there's just, you set up the arrangements, you have somebody takes the operational lead functionally, somebody takes the you know, the commercial and finance lead functionally, you agree who's going to kind of lead on safety and quality. But then, of course, you've got to have systems that, you know, match the highest standard of both. And you know, you could have a number of the personnel from one company or the other, depending on what's going on in the background, but they all just work to the good of the project and the joint venture.
Great. And how's HS2, the JV on that going so far? Are we, what stage are we at? Is it still planning or we got boots on the ground?
No, we're up and running. So we started work on N1 N2 last year. So the first retaining wall structures for one of the launch areas for the TBM on N1 N2 was started last year. and we started excavation of the first foundations on Old Oak Common Station about 2 weeks ago. So we're up and running, and as the year goes on, more and more of the works on M1 and M2 will commence.
It's really a shot in the arm for the industry. I know we've all been struggling the last few years, and mainly due to a lack of work. When you look at the overall order numbers, there's not been enough there, and I think post the Crossrail project, the industry has struggled to have such a major infrastructure scheme happening now, as we come out of this hopefully COVID recovery and even Brexit recovery is really important. I think this has actually been a really good time to bring Nia into the conversation. Nia, I know you've been keeping a close eye on what's been happening with HS2. Do you think you could give us a bit of an update? You mentioned to me the other day about the there was a project in the Chilterns that was moving along apace.
Definitely. So yeah, we're certainly keeping a very close eye on all the works. And as has been discussed today, you know, of course, works has been ongoing for a very long time. And even though, you know, HS2 Limited issued the notice to proceed to the four main works civil contractors last year, that doesn't mean that work started in April last year. I mean, there's been work ongoing for a very, very, very long time. But yeah, so we've been keeping an eye on the Aline JV, just because they're the first ones who have now started tunnelling on the project. So on the whole of HS2, they're the first ones to launch a TBM or a tunnel boring machine. So that was last month.
Aline, remind me who the business is.
So I apologize for my pronunciation now, but it's Bouygues Travaux Publics, and then Sir Robert McAlpine and Volker Fitzpatrick are on the Aline JV. And they've got the Chiltern Tunnels and the Colne Valley Viaduct is what they are working on, basically. And so the Chiltern site, which is next to the M25 in Hertfordshire, it's a big industrial estate currently, pretty much. They've got, you know, they've built sort of factories there, you know, to make the tunnel lining segments and things like that. So it's quite an amazing site at the moment. There's lots going on.
It's going to be when it's complete. I think the Colne Valley Viaduct is probably going to be the most iconic feature of HS2 when it's complete. So looking forward to seeing that develop.
They're also putting together a precast factory for the viaduct there, and they're, I think, piling is ongoing and will be ongoing until the end of this year. And the first TBM was launched last month, and then they're testing and commissioning the second machine. So that's going to be launched in about a month's time, you know, so soonish, depending on how long, you know, all the testing takes. But a lot of exciting stuff happening there. And we did a feature in Ground Engineering's June issue, so that kind of tells the story of what Aline's been doing since they actually arrived on site, and what kind of considerations had to be made regarding the tunnelling methods and the tunnelling machines due to the ground conditions in the Chilterns and so forth. So yeah, if you haven't read that, please go ahead.
Oh, I should check it out. Sounds good. Is there any more features of particular projects on HS2 that you've got in the pipeline?
Not currently, but we'll definitely keep an eye on what's going on. And once, you know, the other JVs continue with their works. Of course, there's lots happening with the other JVs as well. You know, there's piling and earthworks and all kinds of stuff. And the TBM for the under the Long Itchington Wood in Warwickshire is going to be launched this autumn. So there's a lot happening. So of course I'll be in touch with all the JVs to get all the scoops and news from them.
Brilliant.
You can get in touch with us, and we'll give you some good information about that's the first retaining wall structure that we're working on at the moment. So
perfect. Yeah. Sounds great.
Nia, I thank you privately for supporting this podcast, and I'd also like to thank you publicly. I do think it's it's going to be a great way to highlight some of the articles that you're running in your magazine. But not only articles in the magazine, we've also got events coming up. So let's talk about some of those, because I'm sure you'll be looking for people to enter the Ground Engineering Awards, which are in, remind me, November?
Yes, so we're planning on having them on in a physical format on the 23rd of November. So that's still very much the plan. Of course, we'll keep an eye on government advice and so forth, but we really want to get everyone together and meet people face to face again. So that's really what we're planning on. But yeah, so we're still accepting entries for the GE Awards. There's of course 18 different categories, so there's pretty much something for everyone, I'd say. You know, you've got digital innovation, you've got ground investigation project of the year, various projects at, you know, different values, international project of the year, and then there's more company focused ones like specialist geotechnical supplier of the year, and then rising star, you know, always very popular. So early careers, people get then highlighted, which is very important. And this year we've got a new category, which is the Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Champion. So we really want to highlight organizations that have made efforts to develop a diverse and inclusive culture in their workplaces and throughout their workforce. So yeah, that's a new one for this year, which we're quite excited about. And I think we've got a fair few entries for that one. So we're
You kindly asked me to be a judge of that category, which I'm really honoured that you would do that. And I do look forward to hearing the stories about how people have addressed inclusion within their businesses and trying to celebrate that with the rest of the industry. Similarly, on with those career profiles you mentioned, the rising stars, I find it really interesting and inspiring to hear about those journeys, you know, even in their early stages, to see what drives people, what the passions are for geotechnics for young people. So look forward to reading the magazine and seeing those. You've also got the basement conference back again, hopefully. I sooner keep adding that to every social event.
we are planning to do our autumn conferences physically as well. So we've got, as you said, basements and underground structures, which is an annual conference. And we've got it co-located with instrumentation and monitoring this year. So those are planned to happen on the 6th of October. And as I said, physical is what we're going for. We do, I think, you know, it makes sense getting people together. They really, this particular sector, people really enjoy, you know, meeting up, that networking side of things, and you can't really beat physical in that sense. But yeah, the sort of preliminary programs are out there, so please go have a look if you haven't seen them yet. So we're quite excited about having all these physical events in the autumn.
Good. So have you got any of the keynote speakers for the basement conference yet, or was it too early?
I think it's a bit early. We've got some pinned down, but yeah, there. I can give an update at a later stage on those. Yeah,
superb. And Nia, you're going to be coming back sort of once a quarter to join me on the podcast for a little bit of a news update. So thank you for doing that. I think it really adds a lot of value to the podcast. Jane and Phil, I'm sure you'll be going along to one or two of those events as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think the events, and I think we've got the FPS annual dinner is in October, so we're even more hopeful that we can get back together a bit before the GE Awards and celebrate the people that are in the businesses and what they've done. I think as an industry, we've done very well over the last year and a half to deal with the COVID effects and continue. Most of us have been able to continue working reasonably during that period, and that's thanks to our staff who've been at the front line of that, which has been really, really positive for everyone, I hope.
Yes. Yeah, and I think the FPS members have demonstrated, haven't they, just the progress we've made in, you know, as well as looking after our staff, keeping them employed, furlough, but also the mental health arrangements that, you know, and the amount of how we've, you know, done so much going forward to make that everybody's talking point and you know, we're in Piling community, it was very much an undiscussed subject is certainly much, you know, more in mind's eye, and people are discussing openly. I think that's great.
So the plan at the moment for the FPS dinner is to have Ruby Wax as our speaker and co-presenter. So she will be talking more about mental health at that event. And it's so important that we celebrate these good moments. And you know, people have been working extremely hard. I know that the workload has not been as high as over the years, but the people that we have got working in the industry have been working really hard. So please support these events. Please support and reward your staff by taking them along. Well, thank you all so much for joining me. It's been really good to hear more about a subject that I haven't had a great deal of insight or appreciation of in terms of JVs, and good to get a news update from Nia as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
That was one for your CPD record. Next episode, we'll be exploring how we get more young people excited about geotechnics. If you'd like to support this podcast, the best way you can do it is to like or share any social media posts that you see, and that will really help us reach more people. Thanks so much.